Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link with me, Sarah Steffen. Coming up, we'll take a look at what Boko Haram's Pledge of Allegiance to terror group Islamic State could translate to.
The Pledge of Allegiance is almost more of a symbolic nature at this stage. I don't think necessarily there's going to be any operational link between the two groups or any form of operational coordination, but it also doesn't mean that such linkages can't be established in the near future.
And we'll hear from two Nigerians who set out to travel from Lagos to the Arctic. And they say their biggest challenge might be the cold.
I think it's when we get to the Arctic Circle, because it's going to be very cold. You know, we're going all as high as Norway, so I don't like the cold much. So I think that's going to be my most challenging time.
Stay with us for those stories and more coming up in the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
Nigeria's Boko Haram is the latest militant organization to swear allegiance to the Islamic State group, demonstrating what analysts say is the jihadist network's growing ability to attract new backers. Earlier, my colleague Isaac Mugabi spoke to Ryan Cummings, who heads Red24's Political and Security Risk Department on Africa. He started by asking what this kind of allegiance could mean and what kind of support Boko Haram was expecting from the Islamic State's leadership.
Well, firstly, I think we need to speak specifically to what the oath of allegiance entails. I mean, from Boko Haram's perspective, basically what it's done is it's come out and says that it accepts the authority of Islamic State, its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And in that sense, the pledge of allegiance is almost more of a symbolic nature at this stage. I don't think that necessarily infers there's going to be any operational links between the two groups or any form of operational coordination, but it also doesn't mean that, you know, such linkages can't be established in the near future.
Now, we are seeing more cooperation between Niger and Chad in launching attacks inside Nigeria. What lessons are there for Nigeria itself in effectively or dealing with the militants?
Well, I think from Nigeria's perspective, they've come under a lot of criticism for the foreign intervention on its soil and I guess the positive consequences that this is having. Obviously, you know, prior to the multilateral intervention in Nigeria, witnessed in January, the military, the Nigerian military that is, was not making much gains against Boko Haram. I think on the contrary, Boko Haram seemingly was expanding its territorial footprint in Nigeria's northeast. But then we obviously saw the deployment of Chadian forces, and now we have Nigerian forces as well, who are operating inside Nigerian territory, and all of a sudden we obviously seeing significant gains being made against Boko Haram. The massive issue is that Boko Haram had been expanding outside of Nigeria's borders and possibly finding a safe haven in neighboring countries such as Cameroon, Niger, possibly in Chad. And what this meant was that the Nigerian government itself was very constrained in its ability to combat Boko Haram because its mandate only extended to its borders. So often what would happen was that it would launch, you know, significant counterterrorism operations targeting Boko Haram positions, but the group would merely just melt back across the border or possibly just deploy reinforcements and supplies from guerrilla bases in neighboring countries, which, you know, were subject to minimal clampdown from regional governments. And unfortunately, the Nigerian government was facing difficulty in combating the group because its major supply lines, which was coming in from neighboring countries, was left untouched.
Now, in case the Islamic State would accept Boko Haram's allegiance, let's say in a positive way or in some kind of support, how challenging would it be then for Nigeria and its regional allies in dealing with the Islamists?
We still obviously need to wait for Islamic State to formally accept the Pledge of Allegiance from Boko Haram. It usually takes a few weeks if we noted with similar groups that obviously have pledged a similar oath. It's a significant development in the sense that it does elevate Boko Haram among the international jihadist community. This could possibly translate in the sect having access to additional combatants, as it could see Boko Haram coordinating the operations more with some North African groups who are operating under the Islamic State banner. But again, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a discernible change in what's actually happening on the ground in northeastern Nigeria.
My colleague Isaac Mugabe there, speaking to Ryan Cummings, Red24's chief analyst for Africa. The Nigerian government has slammed Boko Haram's pledge of allegiance to terror group Islamic State, saying this pledge was an act of desperation. The terror group wanted to cause fear by affiliating itself with the brutal IS killings. But in fact, Boko Haram has lost ground due to counterattacks by the multinational joint task force. Ben Adam Shimeng with reactions from Nigeria.
The acting director of Nigeria's Army Public Relations, Colonel Sani Usman, said Boko Haram was feeling the heat as multinational joint task force continued to drive out Boko Haram militants in areas previously occupied by the terror group. According to the director of Defense Information, General Chris Olukolade, there is no single territory in Nigeria that will be left in the hands of the terrorists, especially with the support of neighboring countries.
People must understand the total environment of this mission. It enables the Nigerian military on Nigerian soil to chase out these guys and for our partners across the border to equally deal with them from them. But occasionally, there could be cross-border interaction in achieving this, that there is multinational joint task force that involved the activities of the forces from Nigeria, Chad, Niger, Cameroon, who are participating in missions that are even coordinated.
Many Nigerians have come forward and condemned the terror attacks by Boko Haram. They also say that Boko Haram's pledge of allegiance to IS can't be taken seriously.
Well, I heard it, I just laughed. I have a feeling that Nigerian government, Nigerian military has surrounded them up and they are looking for diversionary attention.
Boko Haram in Nigeria, they are a group of confused people. You recall that these are the same set of people who do not have any specific agenda. When they saw that IC was launching Islamic State, they said they are hosting their own flag in some part of Nigeria. So they don't really have a base. They are just looking at international terrorist group, what they are doing to follow suit.
Dr. Halima Akilu, a top officer in the Office of the National Security Advisor to the Nigerian President, says as the military is making progress in the fight against Boko Haram, she's already taken up measures to stop Boko Haram from recruiting new members.
I think the government has put many measures in place, including beefing up the military, giving them better equipment. There's been a lot of training for the men and women of our armed forces. So they have increased the troop strength in the northeast. We're trying to stem the tide of radicalization, stop other people joining, because if they don't have any recruits, the insurgency will die out.
Right now, the insurgents are facing superior firepower from the multinational joint task force.
A report by Ben Adam Shimeng.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
In Mali, fears run high after militants attacked a UN base in the northeastern city of Kidal on Sunday. This attack came just one day after an assault on a nightclub in Mali's capital, Bamako. My colleague Eunice Van Jury spoke to Paul Melly, an advisor with British think tank Chatham House and expert on Mali. She started by asking if the attack on the UN base was linked to the attack in the nightclub.
There is at this stage no way of knowing if there is a direct link between the two attacks. The attack that we've seen in the north on the UN in Kidal is like many attacks by jihadists that have taken place over the last year or so, and including in recent months in Mali. We know that there are jihadist armed groups in the Sahara, and they are continuing to attack international forces from time to time, and that includes both the UN and the French forces, and they've also attacked the Malian army. The attack on the nightclub seems to have also been carried out by jihadists, responsibilities being claimed by the group Al-Murabitoun, but we don't yet have any clear confirmation or proof. It's easy enough for a group to claim responsibility, but actually proving that they were the people who carried out the attack in Bamako is a different matter.
A statement from Ban Ki-moon spokesman said the killing of UN peacekeepers and civilian Malians was intolerable and a breach of international humanitarian law, and asked the government to act. Will Mali's government be able to find the perpetrators and bring them to justice?
It's impossible to know if they'll be able to find the perpetrators. Northern Mali is a huge space. Occasionally, the international forces succeed in killing members of terrorist groups. Occasionally they manage to take them prisoner, but it is not something that is easy to predict. The Sahara is a huge space, and the jihadists continue to get supplies and support from southern Libya, which is a region which has no state authority or control at all. And so there's no particular reason to think that the situation will get better in the near future as far as the terrorist attacks are concerned.
And what security measures has the government been taking to protect its citizens? And what measures will have to be taken after the following attacks?
Well, obviously, in the Sahara, already the UN forces, like the French, like the Malian army, are taking security measures. In Bamako, it's much more difficult. Since the start of the Malian crisis, this is the first conventional urban terrorist attack. And just like terrorist attacks in cities anywhere in the world, the authorities are going to have to strike a balance between improved security for locations that are seen as risky, likely targets and allowing normal life to continue. And that's going to be very difficult.
And how unstable is northern Mali?
Northern Mali is slightly less unstable than it used to be a few months ago because of the progress in the peace negotiations with the groups seeking autonomy. But we can't say that northern Mali is yet stable. There are a lot of underlying problems. It's going to be very difficult to actually make the peace process work and deliver practical results and improvements in people's lives. That's going to be a gradual process.
My colleague Eunice Vanjiro spoke to Paul Melly, an advisor with Chatham House.
Africa on the Move.
Zambia has been battling power shortages for some time now, as the state-owned company failed to meet electricity demands. Hopes are high that this is about to change with a new biogas power plant. The plant will be set up in Zambia's tourist capital, Livingstone, to produce fertilizer and biogas by using wheat from rivers and human waste. Kathy Sikombe has this report.
This is Livingstone, Zambia's tourist capital and home to more than 1 million people. It is also a city plagued by insufficient power supply, owing to a lack of capacity by the state-owned Zambia Electricity Supply Corporation, ZESCO, to meet the demand for electricity. This has resulted in regular power outages, partly due to aging equipment. The Southern African country has had no major investments to raise power generation capacity for decades, forcing it to import electricity from neighboring countries. But this will become a thing of the past as Living Falls Company has embarked on an ambitious project aimed at producing electricity from human waste and water hyacinth, a weed that grows in rivers. Sisko Siamwene, the company's managing director, explains how the project works.
Water hyacinth, it's a weed which grows on water bodies like rivers or nutritious water sewage ponds. So we produce biogas and then give it out to the communities. It's practically waste, and then we generate it into gas, which can be used for cooking and also for electricity generation.
The project is the first of its kind in Zambia. The gas is distributed through a pipe network, and users pay for energy through prepaid meters. Despite being an unwanted weed, water hyacinth is useful for biogas production because it is a relatively cheap and environmentally more friendly product compared to other energy sources. So far, more than 500 households have benefited from the project at a minimum monthly fee of €5 for cooking, heating, and lighting. The beneficiaries no longer need to worry about charcoal or firewood to cook for their families. Caroline Chewe is a case in point.
It has helped us a lot because it's fast. When you put, for instance, shima, it's just maybe 5 minutes and you are done cooking the shima. It's okay. We are just doing fine.
Patrick Sonda, another beneficiary of the project, has nothing but praise for the biopower project.
In terms of the power utility, company which you can see, not even today, we are even connected for about a year now. But with the biogas, when we came here, it was only some few weeks and we were connected with them. And when in terms of cooking, even if it's a big pot which can cater for a funeral, African funeral, it can go about 6 minutes. It's ready. So I believe and I can see that if it is on practical use, you'd be amazed how it works.
And Davis Monga, an environmentalist, says the project has broadened his knowledge about the capacity to generate electricity using alternative means.
As in on my side, I've benefited a lot as in work-wise. I didn't know much about biogas, but at least I've learned something. Biogas is very much cheap. You can't compare biogas to to electricity.
Zambia has the capacity to up its biogas production using water hyacinth, specific energy generating crops, agricultural industry waste and food waste in general. With a pilot project being launched in Livingstone, this may just be the beginning of biogas production in Zambia.
Kathy Sikamba reporting. Cameroon has started renovating a number of buildings that were erected during Germany's colonial rule in the early 20th century. The buildings, which are tourist attractions today, are considered the most solid buildings in an area that's regularly hit by earthquakes. Moki Kinseka reports.
The town of Boya lies at the foot of the majestic Mount Cameroon, which soars to 4,150 meters above sea level, the second highest mountain in Africa after Kilimanjaro. Boya hosted the country's German colonial administrators 115 years ago. They left behind several edifices like the Bismarck Fountain, the Prime Minister's Lodge, the Governor's Lodge, the Boya Mountain Club, and what is called the Schloss, which means castle. They gradually disintegrated to become bush-infested colonial ruins until a year ago. Loudspeakers blast German music from the refurbished Prime Minister's Lodge. 90-year-old Mola Litumbe says the music reminds him of the good old days.
I came with my wife, and I'm so impressed with what has been done. The monument itself is befitting. Like the governor's lodge I've seen behind me, it's well painted. It portrays what the German left to us, and that Boya had once been a national capital and befitting to be the Southwest capital.
Kingsley Tintong is a student at the University of Boya and a photographer. He says the increase in the number of tourists visiting German colonial relics is good for business. He says he makes between $40 to $60 from snapping tourists every day.
Since this place was open to the public, we have tourists from UK. We had researchers. Some were coming for their geological studies up the mountain. We also have schools, companies, people on picnics. I make 20,000, 30,000 a day.
Boya's mayor, Ekema Patrick, told me the government of Cameroon invested $800 million to renovate the buildings, improve the state of roads, and supply electricity. Ekema Patrick says he has asked for financial assistance from Germany to completely renovate the structures.
It has been our responsibility to ensure that these facilities are kept jealously and protected for posterity. And there is an ongoing tender for a German bank. We tendered for 3 projects there. We are sure that we definitely will be given one, because the projects range from 200 to 1.3 billion. If this is done, we think Boya will really look like the kind of Boya we refer to, usually as New Boya.
Among recent visitors to the renovation site is Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, who told a crowd that the facilities were beautiful.
Fellow compatriots, ladies and gentlemen, I have been to Boya several times. Today, I can see that Boya has changed a great deal.
There are buildings constructed by Germans not only in Boya, but all over Cameroon. Many people wish that more modern buildings would be just as solid.
That report by Moki Kinseka.
Making a difference.
And now, for our last story, we hear from two Nigerians who've set out to blaze the trail with a six-week trip that will take them from Lagos to the Arctic. Beyond their urge for adventure and their love for motorcycles, they want to talk to people along the way to show them a more positive side of their home country. Sam Olokoya met the adventurists just before they set off on a journey of over 30,000 kilometers.
Okpemi Fodeke and Tony Adebola were in high spirits as they prepared to set off on their long journey. Adebola explains what he thinks will be the most challenging part of the journey.
I think it's when we get to the Arctic Circle, because it's going to be very cold. You know, we're going all as high as Norway. We're going, you know, really high up, very close to the North Pole. So I don't like the cold much. So I think that's going to be my most challenging time. Yeah, and then we plan to stay in the ice hotel there as well. So it's really adventurous, but, you know, really challenging, yeah. I kind of look forward to it, but I'm also kind of scared of it, you know.
The bikers belong to a motorbike club in Lagos and have been traveling extensively on bike in West Africa in the past. Their bikes are loaded with lots of essential supplies as they make the trip. They are due to drive across West Africa and move to the north of the continent, where they will enter Europe via Spain. On the way to the Arctic in Norway, they will pass such European countries like France and Germany. The two Nigerians are being accompanied by Ralph Goldberg, a British filmmaker who will document the journey. Like the Nigerians, Goldberg is also a motorcycle enthusiast. He says he looks forward to the adventure.
I think in terms of adventure, the section where we travel from Nigeria up Africa to Morocco, that's going to be the most adventurous section, because some countries the roads are not going to be very good and there's going to be lots of different issues and problems throughout the way. But in Europe the roads are quite good, so it's not as adventurous, but then we've got a lot of countries to travel through, we've got a lot of miles to do, so it's still going to be very tough.
But beyond seeking adventure, the bikers also want to use the trip to promote a positive image of Nigeria. The second Nigerian biker, Okpeyemi Fodeke, says they will use several stops on the journey to tell their host about positive things on Nigeria, especially the determination of its citizens to face and overcome challenges.
What we're trying to do is to lay a platform where we can give both ourselves and foreigners the opportunity to talk about something different in the country, fill people with hope that things like this can be done from here. That is the driving spirit that we're trying to show. That, look, we are people who have the power to make change. All we need is the decision to make change. We'll get there by God's grace.
The two bikers, who are successful businessmen, are scheduled to meet lots of people at different scheduled events. They are due to stay in hotels and with people along the way who volunteered to host them.
Sam Olokoya reporting.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.de/AfricaLink. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations, send us your feedback in a text message, and sign up for our newsletter, dw.de/AfricaLink.
And now a quick summary of the stories we've covered. We took a look at what an allegiance between Boko Haram and IS could mean for people's security. In Mali, fear runs high after militants attacked a UN base in the northeastern city of Kidal. And we also heard from two Nigerian motorcyclists who set out to ride from Lagos to the Arctic. And I'm afraid that's the end of our show. For questions and comments, please send us an email to feedback.africa@dw.de. A text message to country code 49160 95 75 95 10, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. Till tomorrow, I'm Sarah Steffen saying thanks for listening and bye for now.